Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hello, it's the Nerdist Podcast number 570. I am currently in one of the synapses that powers the nerd brain of Earth. Yeah, I'm in San Jose right now. San Jose, California. Yes, of course I stopped by the Tech Museum of Innovation. And yes, I did purchase a Periodic Table of the Elements mug because everyone should have one, A. And B, thanks science for having so many elements that it makes for a good size mug for my hot beverages. We're doing Oddball tonight at the Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View, so I decided to stay in San Jose. Why not? Which is Mira Sorvino, who I met a couple weeks ago at the Doctor Who World Tour event, and she's friggin' awesome, and, like, so smart. She speaks several languages. And I made her talk about that a lot, because polymaths fascinate me. Very cool, very sweet, very warm, and a cool hang. So Mira Sorvino, right here in the Nerdist Podcast, number 570. By the way, she's on a show called The Intruders, which is on Saturday nights on BBC America. Watch it. But listen to this podcast first, and then watch it. Or do the reverse. Don't do them at the same time, because that would be shitty to both of us. So one after... Tandem. Do it tandem. But you decide which way to start. That sounded filthy. You know what? I'm going with it.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
The podcast. Have you done a podcast before?
Not one of yours.
Who else are you seeing? Oh God, this is so hard for me.
I don't know. I mean, I've done like radio interviews. That's not the same.
This is like a conversation.
Okay.
Where we don't. You're not going to feel as interrogated. It'll be like a. It'll be like a chat. Okay. Which hopefully will be loose and fun. It's almost like. It's almost like a coffee. Did you spill Coke on yourself?
I did.
Do you want a napkin?
Sorry. It's a mess.
Kyle, take your shirt off. Give her your shirt to wipe. Actually, put your shirt back on. Why did I ask for that? I instantly regret it. Oh my God, you've uncovered this trench of desire, Kyle, that I thought I had. I always wanted to fuck a substitute teacher. I'm sorry. You good over there?
Are we on air now?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's filthy. Yeah, the show's tangentially filthy. It brushes up against mild filth. So please you can say whatever you want. It's totally fine. It was so fun hanging out with you in New York a couple weeks ago.
It was very fun.
We had
Thank
a great
you.
Time. You came. You know this already. This is for the benefit of people listening. You were at the Doctor Who World Tour, right?
Yes.
But you would not really like that.
I had never seen Doctor Who. That was my first. I might have seen a tiny bit of a rerun when I was a kid in black and white on some, you know, weird station. But no, I had never really seen it. It was just because Intruders, my BBC America show, was premiering and airs right after Doctor Who on Saturday nights. And I was in New York promoting that. And they were like, oh, come down to the Doctor Who premiere. So I came down to the Doctor Who premiere.
And John Sim played the Master on Doctor Who.
Yes.
Does he talk about it ever?
I think there's some, I don't know. He doesn't talk about it. No, he doesn't talk about it much. No. There was the day on the set where I was in this little weird Twitter conversation with William Shatner, and William Shatner like all of a sudden got all testy about John Sim being like, I could probably find the exchange, but he was like, oh, Intruders, wait, John Sim is in that. And I said, yes, he's our, you know, he's our leading man. He's like, oh, he's the one who wanted to kick my ass. And there was apparently some whole thing started by the Doctor Who showrunner who said, William Shatner could never play the master. You know, John Sim's the master. John Sim would kick William Shatner's ass.
Oh, well, I'm glad that Shatner caught wind of that.
So Shatner, like, knew about this. And mm-hmm. apparently they'd had some kind of thing already, like, through the press. Mm-hmm. I don't know, some crazy thing. And so then John was like, oh, tell him I have so much respect and love for him. And so I was, like, trying to calm the waters.
And I was
like,
beat
I was
the
not
living
aware.
Shit out of William Shatner.
No. Everybody's like, you know, William Shatner. So there's no way anyone would have any, you know, ill will towards William Shatner, at least not that I'm aware of.
Right. But you know, I don't know. I feel like Shatner could fight. He's been on the show before. He's in good shape. I think he'd give Sim a run for the money, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, I really do. I feel like we need to organize this.
No.
No, all of Nerdkind would love to see Captain
the
Kirk
master
fight the Master.
And Captain Kirk fight.
Yeah, yeah, finally.
It out.
The
yeah.
fight you never knew you wanted to see.
Oh, God. Finally, no, but they're happy now with each other, I believe.
Good.
I think a peace has been brokered.
They're living happily together?
Not together.
Oh, okay.
You know, apart, it far went, apart, different
going,
countries.
I thought
but...
it was going the other way. No. We had such a great chat, but you had said... You were talking to me about, like, contemporary nerd culture because you said when you were in high school... That was your crew.
I was a nerd. Yes, I was a nerd.
No,
sure.
a lot of just I'm sure people are like, really, Mira Sorvino, really? So how? But a lot of things that you told me seemed to check out.
Okay. Did you vet me? Did you go back through my mm-hmm. yearbook?
I went through all your yearbooks.
If you went to the Dwight Englund yearbook, you would see that I was definitely a nerd. Well, I was not. I was certainly not in the. The cool group, which is what we called them, mm-hmm. not the A-list. I don't know. You know, we called them the cool group. I was not in the cool group. I was terrorized by them. I was not in any group because my friends were from different groups. So I had a couple of best friends. And one of them who was there the other night, Rushnik Malik, she is still one of my dearest friends. And we were great friends in high school. We were nerds, although she was less nerdy than me. I had another friend, Elizabeth Wiseman, who was a great, great friend. And, you know, everybody kind of hated us. And, I was in all the honors classes. I did like 6 AP classes, and I got into every college I applied to. So,
including Harvard,
yes. So I was very academically inclined, which made you a nerd automatically. The only boys that liked me in my grade, I mean, there were older boys that I dated a couple times when I was in younger grades, but when I was just in my grade, the only boys that ever liked me played Dungeons and Dragons. That was like their whole life. And then one of them like made a crank, like dirty phone call to me one night. It was very freaky.
One of the D&D guys crank called
yeah,
you?
Yeah,
dirty?
Like, yeah, said something that he wanted to do or I don't know, with heavy breathing and then hung up and it completely freaked me out. Completely freaked me out. What do I have to do to prove the nerddom?
You've just proven it, but I really hope that you went back to your high school reunion.
No, I've avoided them all. I'm too afraid of those people still.
Oscar winner. You should go with your Oscar and land in a private jet.
if
on top of that, those people.
No, if they made my life such a living hell, and I was so intimidated by them that I never wanted to see them again. I was so happy to leave high school, and I was so happy when I got to Harvard and was with a bunch of other people where it was like, oh, it's actually cool to be interested in what you're working on. It's
sure.
actually neat to be talking about like a subject that you're learning about or writing about or researching rather than like just looking down your nose through your perfectly blow-dried wing hair and your perfect clothes that your mom just gave you money for at the New Jersey Mall. And like, because all those girls were so fashionable. I mean, they were so like cutting edge and trendy. And I was like, you know, people used to say, like in middle school, like, oh, Sorvino, where's the flood? Because I was like growing too fast in my shorts. My pants were too short and like my legs were sticking out of them. And then for a while, like I was friends with a bunch of people who were very preppy. And so like I tried some of like the preppy handbook look and that didn't really work out that well for me. Like just, you know, the wide rail cords and the pink and green wasn't really my thing either. And then I finally, like when I was 14, I met Ramon Estevez, who's the middle brother of Charlie Sheen and Emilio Estevez. And we met on the set of a movie that both our dads were working on that championship season. And he was like a punk rock manager. He managed like a ska band, but he was very punk. He wore like these stovepipe, like black, like incredibly skinny jeans, and his hair was dyed like blue, black Elvis, like cut, like with shark skin, like vintage jackets. And I was like, that is cool. See, I want to look like that. So I started picking up a couple of like vintage pieces and, you know, going down to Canal Street jeans and, you know, trying to get some things in my look. A little bit, just a tiny bit of new wave, just a little bit. And that at least gave me some sort of originality in my wardrobe that wasn't like New Jersey Mall and it wasn't like preppy. So
I feel like the nerd response to, hey, Servino, where's the flood? Well, if current global warming trends continue, then the flood will actually be everywhere because the glaciers are melting at an alarming rate. And then you get stuffed in a trash can. For me, it was getting stuffed in a trash can. I got stuffed in a trash can because I had, I was the D&D kid, and so I brought all my, like, I would bring, they were really fucking heavy, but I would bring the extra D&D books to school. There were a lot of them, and they were thick. Like, the DM guide was thick. And the Monster Manual, and the Fiend Folio, and Unearthed Arcana, and all these different books, they were big books. They were not small. They did not be like, kids are going to have to carry these around. They were thick books. Also, I'm sorry I called and breathed heavily on the phone that one time.
No, it wasn't you. It was Mark Svensson.
Mark Svensson?
It's Svensson, yeah.
Svensson.
It was. I think it was with a V, but it might have been pronounced like a W or vice versa.
Whatever happened to him? Do you know?
I don't know what happened to him.
So you're on Twitter, but are you on Facebook or anything else?
I'm on Facebook, but I'm so bad at it. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I cannot really operate Facebook. Like, I need a tutorial from the Facebook people because when I try and do something, it won't allow me to do it. It sends me somewhere else.
Oh, like, that's just Facebook.
Hit something and I land somewhere completely different. I can't even read my own damn feed that I try and see whether something I've tried to post has appeared.
Sure.
I can't even get to my own feed, like what I wrote. Like, I can't post photos. I can't like change something in my like about you, like where are you working. Like, I wanted to add intruders because it has falling skies and it does not allow me to add. Like, I can't change, you know.
What if the problem was that you just weren't signed in?
No, I'm signed in, but it just doesn't. No, I just can't do it. I
mean, someone, like, from Facebook, will you please help Mira Sorvino? This woman needs your help to operate.
I only started Facebook like a year ago, honestly, so I don't, maybe that's it, but I'm the last living human to join Facebook, but I do Twitter, which I find easier, and Instagram, which I find easiest. Instagram's the easiest, but I don't.
Are you just Mira Sorvino and Instagram as well?
Both, yeah.
Okay. So, so people who grow up, it sounds like we had kind of similar experiences, and mine was more in grade school, but I went to three different high schools, so I kept trying to start over, and it just never fucking worked. I always slid back into the old habits. I could pretend for like a month, and then it was just like I would just slide back into the old habits. But did you ever feel okay with yourself, or did that? I mean, you know, you're standing on stage at the Academy Awards, and you're like, do you feel like I feel cool, or were you like, oh, I shouldn't have this. That's weird. I don't know. But do you still? Did you try to emotionally sabotage it?
No, I mean, I think I tried to like leave high school far, far behind and never look back. But I mean, there were moments like, cause I think it was things like when I was like 16, I was just sitting outside, like, and it was like a study hall period or something. And I was just outside in this courtyard sitting on a bench, reading a book, and a window from up above opens up and this boy calls out, Mira Sorvino is ugly.
Oh, no.
And I just was crushed because I was like, you know, if he was doing this to Denise Waltuck, like, he would never have done this because she's pretty and no one would have said that to her. So it must be true. Like, it must be true. I am ugly and just deal with it. And like, because he would never said that.
You got trolled in real life.
That if he ever thought, you know, like, he wouldn't have said that to me if he thought I was pretty, because it would have destroyed any chances he would have with me or whatever. I don't know. So I was just mortified. And so that stayed with me for years and years, along with my sister saying to me constantly, go back to the farm, pig nose. So that was her favorite epithet to me. So I had this real insecurity about, you know, being attractive or whatever. And then years later, when I started getting a modicum of fame, Us magazine, Us Weekly, before it was the magazine it is now, when it used to be more of like an entertainment magazine,
yeah,
which was like all these portraits, beautiful portraits. Remember they had that book, Crazy, Sexy, Cool, that they put out with all these huge, beautiful portraits that they did of all these actors and singers. So they used to be much more sort of editorial than gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some piece on me, and in it they like had me like, I was posing in like some kind of tough girl outfit. And then I get this letter in the mail, and it's not an email because there's no email yet in my life. It's just like, it's just a physical letter from the boy who yelled out the window.
Oh.
And he said, "Way to go, you rebel bad girl. You, they certainly put you in the right section." And the section I was under was looking good. And it was like this smarmy, weird kiss ass letter where he was like, "So, you know, like maybe we could hang out," or, you know, I don't even know if he asked for anything in it, but it was like this like compliment of like,
sure,
me looking cool in the magazine.
Right.
And it was that same guy. And it just stunned me because I'd been carrying around his like insult for like almost a decade on my back. Like it was like my mark of shame, you know? And now he's writing this stupid kiss ass letter to like, I don't know what. Maybe he felt guilty, or maybe he honestly just wanted to kiss ass to somebody who he now knew that was now in a magazine. But
I think he probably wanted to touch you in inappropriate ways at that point.
I don't know.
And realize he blew his chance.
I don't know. But that made me like crack up and be like, okay, you can't take anything personally. You can't believe anything, the good or the bad. Like you can't like take somebody's extremely high praise when it's like over the top, nor can you take like the evil comments. You just have to stay the course and have your own like sense of self-esteem.
Well, especially in that age range. I mean, I remember meeting up with this girl that tortured me in grade school. She was awful to me. And she was one of the people that had always just sort of stuck in my side. Like, you know, cause I don't know. It's just when it's like your brain is soupy and then it starts to harden in your teenage years. And it just, like those things kind of harden in your brain like concrete, where you're like, oh, just like what you said. And I hung out with her years later, and I was prepared to be like, yeah, so what was your problem? And she was like, you know, by the way, I was such a bitch to you back then. I don't know. Like my parents were having a rough time. And I was like, oh. Just like ripped the emotional carpet off from underneath me. Like, oh, okay. But then just to sort of realize like, yeah, none of that stuff really, you know, everyone... Kids are just
Everybody's going through stuff. No idea what's happening, and you know,
kids don't know how to pretend as well as adults, so they're just shitty if they feel bad.
And also, I mean, like, you know, in New Jersey, like everybody's parents were divorced, and I thought I'd beat that curve, and then my parents got divorced while I was in college. But you know, so people are going through so much, and you know, who knows how best to handle it. So I don't think I hold a grudge against those people, but I was still like afraid of them. So I've never gone to a high school reunion is like the bottom line. I've gone to two Harvard reunions, which have been immensely amazing and fun and nostalgic and emotional. But no, I've had no wish to go back to my high school.
So how did you grow up?
But that's why I did Romeo and Michelle. I did it for the girls that felt like me. I was like this, because people are like, this is not the film you want to do right after winning the Oscar. I was like, but this is like for nerd girls everywhere. This is like, you know, anthemic. Like, you know, these are like nerd superheroes.
Romeo
like,
and Michelle, such a fucking great movie. And we had the conversation because you guys came to the Singled Out set where Romeo and Michelle get rejected for being too old.
Yes. Sadly, and that was already like 1995. Like, how old am I now?
But that was like, and Janine was in that movie too, yeah. And the fucking the fast burning cigarette paper. That movie was great, and also, but you and Lisa were great in that. But both had the really, I don't know. You were sort of doing this character, like this girl, and where did she come from?
Well, her voice was basically my sister's, and then I just dropped the register. My sister used to talk like that, and she used to have this best friend called Murph. And they would like talk like that together. I'm like, okay, Murph. And they just did these voices. She always did stuff with her voice, like comedic stuff with her voice. But she adopted this kind of Valley girl patois. And even though she was raised in Tenafly, New Jersey. So I just imitated that, but then kind of made it lower.
And then after Romeo and Michelle.
But I also felt like physically she was basically like a linebacker in high heels. You know, like, you know, the way like a guy walks when he's like, you know, doing some like spoof and drag, you know,
yeah.
But he's never put on high heels before or never will again. And he's like 200, 15 pounds in, like, you know, spike heels. That's what I tried to make Romy's gait like, you know. And she thinks she's smart, but she just isn't.
That movie did well, if I remember right. Didn't Romy
Michelle do well? It did well. It would have done better had it not been rated R, because I don't think anyone understood at the time that its main audience, I think we understood the actors, but was going to be teenage girls, because they were going to relate to us. Because people thought, I think, that were marketing the movie, that it was going to be for 30-year-olds who were going to their high school reunion. And we were like, the characters may be like, I don't know, they were like 28 or whatever, but they are not mentally 28. They're still in high school in their minds. Like, they are really, really young. So the market for this is like people who are in high school.
Why
still.
Why was it rated R?
Because of Janine's language, because of the go fuck a sheep, go fuck your sister. Go. If you fuck in a sexual sense on camera, you are automatic R.
But if you use it in a religious sense, then it's...
Well, if you use it in just like a, ow, I stubbed my toe kind of way, you can use one or two of those. But first of all, there's also a number of them. And so she does like five of them in a row, and that's probably already over the number. But if you use it in a sexual sense, it's automatic R, which is crazy, because if you look at the stuff that gets a PG-13 that is so violent, it's like crazy.
Well,
intense.
Also the internet, like, people are fine with language now. It's the same. It's the same thing on At Midnight, where its standards are, you can use something colloquially, but you can't use it anatomically. So like, if I were to say like, that dick kicked me in the dick, one of those would get bleeped. And I think actually we did that. You know what? I actually demonstrated that on the show. There was a picture of someone, because it's the internet, made a cross section of a pregnant lady, and there was a cat inside her womb. And I said, that pussy's going to come out of that pussy, and one of those just got bleeped. And they did. One of the pussies went through, and the other one got bleeped. And it just is like so ridiculous that these are the rules. It's like that, you know, that someone would be like, oh, okay, but as long as you know, you said the word, but not that thing. That people were just, I think we just need to get over the language stuff. And this is like, there are worse things in the world, right? There are way worse plagues in the world than whether or not someone says fuck on television or film. So where do we go from here?
I don't know. You took us here. I'm not sure where we're going now.
No, I don't mean us. I mean as a culture.
Oh, I don't know. I mean... Yeah, that's hardly the worst thing. I don't know. If you look back just like to when I was a kid, and what there was on television was so tame. I mean, it was like the Brady Bunch. You know, I would go home from school and I would watch reruns of the Brady Bunch in the afternoons. Like, that was the television. Or maybe I would watch I Love Lucy. I mean, I would watch something completely innocuous. And all the barriers are gone now. And I'm just wondering what long-term effect that has on people. Like, because obviously not every family is going to be as careful as I am about what my kids can watch. Like, I don't let them watch racy stuff, and I don't let them watch violent stuff. But there's lots of other homes where it's a little more laissez-faire. Like, if I had wanted to watch the violent stuff when I was a kid, I probably could have.
Sure.
Because my parents were sort of not paying attention to what I was watching. And I was just hard. Like, I saw something when I was 10 where this guy got like stabbed in the stomach in this alligator movie, and it freaked me out so much that I couldn't like handle it. So I didn't gravitate towards that stuff. But if I had, you know, had just been kind of randomly watching, now kids can, like, they could watch Dexter. I mean, they could watch, you know, who knows what they're picking up. So I don't know what it's going to do. Yeah, the language is the least of our worries, is what I'm basically saying. I don't know.
How did you turn out? I mean, as a child in an actor family, how did you turn out normal? I mean, like, how'd you turn out normal in the sense that, you know, I'm sure you saw a lot of your dad's friends, and there were some probably messed up kids. So how did you turn out to be this normal nerdy girl who went to Harvard, and like, what was the...
Well, my parents were fairly normal. They didn't live like a Hollywood lifestyle. They didn't do drugs. They didn't party a lot. I mean, dad and mom decided when I was in third grade that dad was going to go off to work and we were going to just stay in one place rather than us sort of gypsy following him from set to set. And although great for stability, bad for marriage. I think ultimately that broke up my parents' marriage, because the distance for months and months at a time was not good.
Yeah.
But they were very committed parents, very loving, very kind of old fashioned and conservative in a way, and very, very supportive of our academic work and all of our extracurriculars. They were very, very involved. So if parents are really involved and really love you and really, you know, kind of are there for you to kind of navigate the things that you're going to be going through, then you tend to hopefully avoid the pitfalls of teenagehood that could really get you down. I mean, I think it's when parents are not around.
Right.
You know, when kids are neglected, and, you know, that does happen probably in certain Hollywood families because the parents are working so much, or maybe they're, maybe they've adopted the kind of culture of hedonism that, you know, the life of being an actor can afford you if you want it.
I mean,
you know, actors could go out partying every night. They could go home with a different person every night. They could do drugs all the time if they wanted. That's something that is available to actors that is not necessarily available to bankers or, you know,
it's not available
teachers.
To TV hosts either, unfortunately.
But my parents didn't involve themselves in any of that. I mean, that's not who they are.
Yeah.
My dad is, like, you know, from this Italian-American family, very family-oriented. My mother's parents were both educators. They're very, like, clean-cut American family. Like, you know, they're very conservative, family-oriented people. So that just wasn't the way that we were raised.
Did your dad have a bunch of brothers and sisters?
He has two brothers.
Oh, okay.
And they're both still alive, Uncle Ronnie and Uncle Billy. And they both are in the East Coast right now. All three of them are there right now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom's Italian, and so but my grandfather had like 10 brothers and sisters.
My grandfather was one of nine.
They just came over from Italy, and just like, you know, they were teenagers when they got, my great grandparents were teenagers when they got together. So they just started this weird human pyramid scheme of Italians. It was just, I have so many cousins for all that I don't even know, you know, and. It's actually Facebook now that's started to reconnect my mom to the rest of the family. It's, I'll just hear like, oh, Uncle Frankie's kids, you remember them? Like, no. I don't know. It's a big clan. But there is something about that Italian-American family idea. It's like big families, and they every Sunday, you know. Like,
yeah, the Sunday dinner, everybody together. We still do that with my dad. My kids and my husband and I, we all descend upon my dad's apartment in West Hollywood, and he cooks some giant feast, or he'll
great.
Come to our house, and we'll do the same there, and everybody goes swimming or whatever. So it's like we try and keep it up as much as possible. I mean, my grandparents were omnipresent in my childhood. They were always there. My grandmother was like my favorite person in the whole world. She was, in her own words, as big as a house and totally fine with it. And the best cook, the most comforting, wonderful, funny person, down to earth, earthy, like just had this great joy of life and just was sort of an example for me of how to like be a person. So I don't know. We just, that family orientedness has stayed with us, and that's, you know, how we want to live too. So we try and.
And does that sort of help not get sucked into, did you ever get sucked into all of the Hollywood-y stuff, or were you always able to sort of like, nah, that's dumb. It's not real.
I think, you know, in my 20s when I was single and kind of, you know, had my chance to kind of run around and go to parties and do things, like I was probably, you know, sort of, I was never a drug doer. I'm not a drug person at all, but I probably, you know, had my share of cocktails and went to parties and, you know, I had fun. I definitely had fun, but I was never really wild. I always still had that sort of good girl thing inside me that would stop me from doing crazy things. I would always have this like limit that would kind of, oh no, I'm not going to do that. Sorry.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. I mean, you are who you are. So.
And did after Romy and Michelle? I mean, still the idea of like the pinnacle of what you can achieve in this business, you achieved. And is it once it happens, are you like, oh yeah, I guess that happened, or does it feel like anything? I mean, I guess maybe it's hard. It's probably hard to put into words, but I guess thinking of it in terms of, you know, someone has an ultimate goal for their career. Was that an ultimate goal, or was it just like, oh, this is a nice reminder that I'm on the right path? Or how did it emotionally?
It was never a goal of mine. I honestly, my goal was to be as good as an actor as I could be and do great work, you know, inhabiting characters, bringing them to life and getting to work on great material. And that was my goal. I really didn't have like an achievement goal of like, I need to win an Oscar and I need to be acclaimed. I just wanted to be a working actor doing wonderful work because that's why I became an actor. And my dad was an actor, so I saw it as this great craft, this artistry that he engaged in that I saw from the time I was very small. And I saw a kind of nobility to the work because he put such intense work into it and how he developed his characters, how he would like, he played this character in this movie called Dummy, where he played a deaf lawyer based on a real man named Lowell Myers. And LeVar Burton played a deaf mute kid that he's defending in the court system who's accused of rape and murder. And my dad developed three different stages of deaf speech because the character became profoundly deaf at 12. And the story takes place over 20 years. So in the beginning, he's closer to the time that he lost his hearing. And then by the end of the show, he's much older. And so he's losing all of his plosives and his consonants. And it's getting much harder to understand him and harder for him to stand in court and give a talk to hearing people because they can't understand how he's speaking. But he worked with deaf children in this Lexington School for the Deaf for weeks. And he did all this work with tape recorders. And he met the real guy. And then he realized when he met the real guy that the voice he had been developing for him was completely wrong because this guy had a different tone of his voice, so he brought it to that. And it was all, it was very painstaking, like the way that, you imagine a great artist is working on a canvas, like that, this sort of dedication and patience and instinct that they bring to it. So for me, just doing the work was kind of the goal. And I always had this fantasy that wouldn't it be great if I could be like in all these great parts, but no one knew who I was in real life because I really didn't like the spotlight.
Yeah.
I was not the life of the party. That is my dad. My dad loves to be in the spotlight. He loves being the center of attention. He loves telling the jokes at the parties. That's not me. I'm more, internal than that and not as comfortable. And it's taken me years to be comfortable doing like press lines. Like I really can't stand like the red carpets. I really can't.
They're completely uncomfortable, artificial and, like, environments.
And those photographs, like the flashlights blinding you. I mean, yeah. It's like you're blinded and you're standing there and you're so self-conscious. And I used to just be so terrified when I would hit the red carpet. Now I'm still a little terrified, but it's a little bit less daunting. But that was my fantasy to be like a fully working film actor who no one knew. That was like my little, and so the Oscar was incredible. It was an amazing honor. It was like this gift that I never expected. It just kind of came out of the sky and hit me on the head. And the night that I got it, when they called my name, because I was just preparing to be happy for someone else. I never thought I would get it. And when they called my name and I floated up to the stage. I felt like my feet did not move. I was literally, levitated up the stairs onto the stage in my big skirt. And I felt this like wave of love from the audience and from like the people watching the broadcast. I felt like this like immense wave of love was washing over me. And I'm not a new agey person, but like that's how it felt. And so I will always treasure that and always carry that with me. But as I said, it was never one of the things that I was like, well, when I get my Oscar, that will mean that I had a meaningful life and a meaningful career. It was just a beautiful gift and a beautiful thing that I treasure.
What did you major in college?
I was East Asian Languages and Civilizations. I was basically Chinese studies, but I wrote my thesis on racial conflict between Chinese students and African students in the PRC. And it was something that happened while I was there. These racial outbreaks were happening, and I was like, wait, I've always wanted to understand prejudice and racism better. Let me study it in a Chinese context, see what part of it is cultural, what part of it is social, what part of it is economic.
Did you discover?
It was very interesting. I mean, at the bottom of it, at the bottom of this conflict, it all came down to interracial dating. It was all sex. It was all like, you can't cross those color lines. And like, there was just sort of this crazy reaction from, the host country that African male students were coming and they wouldn't send, it was 50 men to one woman in this program. It was this program where the Chinese government was giving free graduate education to third world country graduate students in an effort to kind of cadre-ize the third world, mm-hmm. like to kind of Mao-ize, their allies. And so, and it was something that was started by the Soviets. It's like a way of kind of planting seeds of communism in mm-hmm. the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And so they would bring over these grad students, but only one woman to 50 men. So, and they would be there for 3 years at a time. So obviously they would date locally. And that was just seen as anathema by the local population. And then there was this whole thing. There was all these, people marching with like placards saying, democracy now. And then at the same time, there would be another one, black devils leave our women alone. And I was like, what in the world? So I just started looking into it more and more. And, it was interesting because the, Obviously, the the African students were getting privileges that the Chinese students didn't have. Like the government was giving them larger stipends. They'd have like nice dorm rooms. They didn't have to sleep like 16 to a dorm room as the Chinese would. They would be like two or one to a room.
Oh, so there was already bitterness.
There was resentment. And then there were totally different like cultural mores at hand. Like, you know, the Chinese were like, you know, all their teaching from the time they were very young was sort of dedication to the group, to the state, to like being a good citizen of China, not for individualism. And the African students were much more kind of party oriented and boisterous and happy and would play loud music. And, you know, we're not coming from at all that same sort of groupthink. And, you know, there were just clashes on all different levels. But honestly, all the fighting generally came from interracial dating, like all the problems. It was crazy. It was really interesting. And, you know, part of what I was studying was just, you know, the certain things about racism in every context or prejudice that, unfortunately, the way we're sort of hardwired as evolutionary creatures is that we have fight or flight instincts. And part of those are to sort of typecast others around us. Like if you're our clan, if you're the X clan, you're okay. If you're in the Y clan, maybe you're dangerous. And so I've got to treat you like you're dangerous to stay alive. Like if there's lightning, I shouldn't go out because maybe the lightning's going to kill me. Now, even though if there's thunderclouds, maybe there's not going to be lightning and maybe it's not going to kill you. But certainly by going out, you're running more of a risk of getting killed, right? So we're sort of hardwired. The brain likes to make associations, likes sure. to say, okay, the red-colored things are bad, the blue-colored things are good, and I'm on the blue team. So all the red is bad and I'm blue. And you have to sort of break yourself of these kinds of tendencies to type people. It was interesting because what I basically learned was that if you don't change those assumptions by the time a person is like an adult, the only way they will change is through a life-threatening experience where a member of the other group saves them. And this is how like skinheads become fair-minded people. Like they're drowning and a Jewish person or a black person saves them. Afterwards, they're like, whoa, okay, I'm wrong.
So you basically have to be in that moment where
everything shatters and right. you're like, okay, I've got to reinvent the wheel. This is crazy. Because otherwise what people tend to do who are prejudiced is that they will exceptionalize people they meet that don't fit the mold that they've created in their mind of like the bad other. So that's why you have people who are kind of apparently racist or prejudiced, but they'll say, oh, some of my best friends are X, you right. know, because they can exceptionalize, like there are good ones, but most of them you have to be careful
right,
about.
Right, right, right.
You know, so it was very interesting. And it's just like in every culture, you have racial conflict and you have prejudice. And it was just kind of what were the historical factors and what I was finding was that the government was having less and less need for that program. Mm-hmm. Because they now had their own seat in the United Nations. You know, they'd been working for that for decades. And now, like, their economic and political need for these third world supporters was growing less. And so they were being more open, or they were not brushing conflicts under the rug as they had earlier. Because these conflicts had started almost as soon as the African students got there in, like, 1948 and 50s. Like, they were having fights early on, but the government would try and clean it up and make it nice and pretty and apologize. When I was there, they were not only not doing that, they incarcerated six of the African students who were involved in this big fight down near Nanjing. And then they took all the foreign students who were trying to go back to their embassies for the Christmas break and took them away from the train station where they were waiting for a train to get to Beijing, and instead took them to this place called the Shupu Guest House, which was this weird hotel where they separated people by country and they struck people with electric cattle prods.
Oh my
and they
God.
Put six African students in solitary confinement. And it was crazy. I mean, it was a crazy incident. So it really showed that the government no longer cared about losing face internationally about what those countries thought of them, like that the value had dropped for them. So they weren't going to really cover up incidents. And in fact, it almost seemed like they were fomenting them. But
did you go to China?
Yeah, I was living there at the time. I was living in Beijing.
And so do you speak Chinese?
I do.
You do?
Uh-huh.
That's the hard. I mean, I was trying to learn Japanese.
Japanese is harder, maybe.
Do you think so?
The grammar is harder, and you have those. The reason I didn't, like, right off the bat, the reason I didn't want to learn Japanese is because they have that inferior superior grammar. So you always have to talk up to your superiors and down to your inferiors. And as a woman, you always had to talk up.
Oh shit!
Yeah, like there are certain, you could never be completely an equal with everyone that you spoke to. Like, you were always going to have to speak in a subservient way towards men and bosses and things like that. So that kind of freaked me out. But I also loved traditional Chinese culture. I love Japanese culture too, but like, I had something in me, I don't know, maybe I was Chinese in another life or something, that I just was fascinated with traditional Chinese culture. So
what are some basic, what are some of the, because learning an Asian language is, because I studied Latin in high school because I went to all boys Catholic school, you know, and so Latin is a romance language. And so you have the basis for basically most of the, I mean, English is not a romance language. It's a Germanic language, but there's still a lot of basis of Latin and Greek in our language, not so much structurally, but at least vocabulary wise. But you're talking about an entirely separate language family with completely separate roots and a completely separate alphabet and way of communicating, and
it's not even an alphabet.
Almost pictograms, really.
Right. Well, they were pictograms, and they did used to have, and in Japanese they still have them, but they would have a meaning root that you could kind of decipher, but then Mao Zedong changed them. He took what they used to call fantizi, which are like complicated characters, and changed them to jianhuazi, which are simplified characters, so that the masses could learn to read, because there were like 13 strokes in some of the old ones, and then he would simplify them, but in doing so destroyed the original tie to the meaning, because they used to have like a radical that meant fire, and one that meant like books, and one that meant sun, and you could kind of piece together a little bit visually, okay, I understand why that is that word, because
now it's just a memorization
now
game.
It's just memorization. I mean, once in a while that the sort of root of that radical is still in there, but a lot of times it's gone completely. It's just pure memorization. And I did write myself an essay on my early Mac, you know, one of those giant Macs that had like the floppy disk inserts. Why Chinese ruins my life. I think I wrote that to myself in like sophomore year. But, you know, I stuck with it, and I was very glad I did. And, you know, look, I had, I should say I had a wonderful time in China, and I had the best people that I became very, very close to. So even though my thesis explored a conflict that was happening there, it was not an indictment of the Chinese people. I mean, racism is everywhere and racial conflict is everywhere. So, and the Africans were not completely innocent either. Nobody's completely innocent, but, so I didn't want this to be like a slam on Chinese people, cause I love Chinese people, but, it was an amazing experience. It was really interesting. I was very lonely for the first 3 months, and I felt like I couldn't understand anything. Like, people were just speaking a little too fast. Like, the words would just, if they just slow down, I could catch them. And then all of a sudden, it's like one day it sounded like they started speaking slower.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's like my brain caught up, and then it sounded like normal speed speech. And I could now understand what they were saying, and I could bargain on the street and buy street food and, you know, do what I needed to do in Chinese all the time. And I ended up renting a room from a Chinese woman. And I left the school, and I just started doing like jobs. Like, I took a semester off from college, because my parents, that's when the divorce was finalized, and I just needed to be kind of away. So I was working on my thesis. I was editing Chinese language magazines published in English. I was editing the English, and like, there were words like one of the words that was in the translation was electric brainwashers. And I was like, electric brainwashers? What is this? You know, like, and then it turned out it was like computerized washing machines. But electric brain is the literal translation for the Chinese word for computer.
Oh, right. Electric brain.
Now, like, electric brain is a computer. So it's like, so that was one of my jobs. I taught English to like middle school kids, and I sang jazz with a couple of jazz bands. And that was really
fun. Chinese?
No, in English and in French.
What an amazing... Well, no wonder you didn't get sucked into the Hollywood scene. You were fucking right about racial conflicts between Africa and China, and learning and singing jazz in China. getting out and seeing that the world is bigger than this weird little insulated bubble that we live in right here. I guess that would, expanding your horizons in that way would probably kind of make you come back and go, yeah, this stuff's fun, but it's not the world. You know, there's actual important things going on in the world. This stuff's neat, but it's not, you know, it's not that. What did you learn? when you learn a language that's complex as Chinese, does it make you understand English better? Does it make you what are the sort of side effects to learning?
Well, I would dream in it, and I was really excited when I would dream in it, because once I was living with my Chinese friend, I didn't have any English in my life anymore, except for like writing my parents or calling them on the phone or something. Or if I'd run into one of the American students, like my whole day would be in Chinese. Everything was in Chinese. So that was pretty cool, actually. It was cool to live in another language, because there's a fun emotional rhetoricalness to Chinese. Like if you could be like, come on, am I right or am I wrong? I'm not wrong. You know, like the statements are like, kubushima, like, can you say no? Can you say it's not true? You know, and then you go on and things are like there's this funness to it. Like it's very, very expressive. It's not the formal polite language that the Japanese is. It's much more rhetorical and fun. Like there's a kind of, I don't know, I can't explain it.
Do you ever go into Chinese restaurants and then see if they talk about you and then answer them in Chinese and go, I know what you're saying.
No, I get really shy in Chinese restaurants. I almost never speak. But I don't go to Chinese restaurants much because I'm very, very allergic to MSG.
Oh, okay.
It makes me completely sick. So while I was in China, I thought I had colitis or colon cancer because I was so sick from the MSG.
Oh, but it was MSG.
I had to have like a CAT scan and everything. It was crazy.
Oh, my gosh.
But it was just MSG. Yeah. So I do want to actually... Two of my sons just told me yesterday that they want to study Chinese. So... one of them was studying French up until last year, and now he's decided his best friend's going to study Chinese, so he's going to study Chinese. So they're both going to take Mandarin at their school. So I got to brush up the Mandarin now. My daughter is still taking French, and I also speak French, so that will be easy to, you know, the Chinese will be a little harder to coach him on. So I'll have to go back and like maybe hire the teacher from the school to just like talk to her a few days.
Polymath. Would you be able to, if there was a French person and a Chinese person, would you be able to bridge the gap between the two of them pretty well?
Yes, except then I'd probably say a few French words in the Chinese sentence. Like that was like when I was interviewing subjects for the thesis, like I was interviewing French, African, Francophone speaking African students. Like I was like smuggled into this embassy to talk to one of them. And so I was trying to interview them in French, but Chinese words kept jumping into the French, which was really weird. And it would completely fry my brain. Like in the middle of a sentence, I'd use like a Chinese word instead of a French word. And then now my French is stronger than my Chinese. So like, I don't know, it would be tough. The same thing happens to me in like Spain and Italy, because if I've been speaking Spanish most recently and then I'm in Italy, like I'll come up with a Spanish word. Next, my Italian and Spanish are both pretty poor, but they're quite similar, but not. They're not the same, but they sound a lot the same, and your brain will sort of remember one instead of the other. So, I don't know. My brain is failing now. I've got to do like Lumosity or something.
Yeah, they would do that Italian was my language in college, and people would always come in and throw in the, you know, like they would throw in a Spanish word. And then the teacher would be like, oh no, molto bene, like that she would correct, and seemed very frustrated by the fact that Spanish was leaking its way into her precious Italian. But they're so similar in a lot of ways that's easy to make that jump. But from French to Chinese is kind of, that's interesting to think how the brain processes.
Well, some of the words sound sort of similar in a way, or there's like, because I used to speak Chinese in a kind of a soft way, which kind of was like almost like a French way of speaking Chinese. It was kind of weird. I don't know. I can't explain it. But it's like my personality is slightly different in each language, because you adopt a little bit of the style of the country.
Sure.
Yeah. So
in order to communicate and fit in, I guess you would have to.
But you kind of develop, it's almost like playing a character, right? Like, so you develop, like say Romy talks in that way.
Yeah.
Like French Mira is not quite the same as American Mira. Or Chinese Mira is not quite the same as French Mira or American Mira.
Oh, wow. I guess that...
But they're both limited by the non-perfectness of my level of fluency.
So who's the real Mira? Who is she?
I don't know.
Who is she really? Is she French or Chinese or Spanish or Italian or American? What is she?
Non so.
Mi dispiace. Mi dispiace. Sono un americano. The thing that was frustrating about going to Italy and speaking Italian was that regionally the dialects, like their words are different, and the regions aren't necessarily even that far apart.
Right.
And basically when you kind of get it down, like in Milano, and then you go to Venezia, then you say something and they're like, no, we don't say that here. It's here we say, you know, right. And you're like, fuck, but over there, they said, and they're like, oh, that's not how it, you know. I don't know, everybody sounds like a Mario. But
my dad speaks Italian and then he sings in Neapolitan because his family is from, his dad was from Naples and he came over here when he was four. And so when he's in Italy, he can tell little jokes and anecdotes in Neapolitan, but he doesn't really speak fluent Neapolitan, but it's totally different from Italian. I mean, it's like really different.
Oh, wow.
It's a completely other language really in a way. But he can kind of fool the people for a little while that he's fluent in Neapolitan. He is quite fluent in actual proprio Italiano. But
did you ever do any Chinese films or any Chinese?
No, I did a film with Chow Yun-fat called The Replacement Killers, directed by Antoine Fuqua.
Yeah.
But in that, I didn't speak any Chinese, actually. My character was American.
Did you talk to him in Chinese?
Like, a little bit.
Hey, Chow Yun-fat, guess what?
But, you know, he's not, that's not his main language. He's actually speaks a southern dialect, not Mandarin. He can speak Mandarin, but that's not his comfortable language.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's like as though he's from Naples and he's then Italian is, you know, being asked of him and he can speak it in films and he can speak it to people, but his real language is a different language.
Did you think it was ever, I mean, there must have been you could do commercials in like four or five other countries. did you ever do anything?
The funny thing is like when I was younger, like doing commercials was like looked down upon.
But in other countries, a lot of the actors got away with it.
Yeah, some did. I never did. And then now everybody does everything.
Right.
And nobody cares. Like everybody is just making a buck everywhere you turn, selling something somewhere.
Oh yeah, everything.
Perfume. I mean, when Nicole Kidman did like Chanel or whatever, you're like, okay, anyone can do anything now.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah, the gloves are
Brad
off.
Brad Pitt is doing a perfume. Anyone can do anything now.
Well, that the dirty actor secret, at least, you know, 20 years ago was actors going over to, I guess that's sort of what Lost in Translation was about, actors going over to Japan.
Japan, yeah.
And
yeah.
We're being like in a pre-internet era where it's like, no one will ever fucking see.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I never did any of those. I didn't. I missed the boat on those. I missed the revenue stream that way. Yes.
So what, how old are your kids?
9, 8, 5, and 2.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty,
We had them bang, bang, bang. Yeah. So, you know, I had 4 kids under 7 at one point.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I hope you had some help.
I have help. I have help. Not full-time help, but I have help.
Does it freak you out in a sense? Or like, I'm responsible for 4 lives? Or is it sort of like, does the Italian Sorvino come out and go, I know, this is what it's supposed to be?
Well, I always wanted 4 kids. I came from a family of 3 kids and I loved having my brother so much. When he was born, it was like the best day of my childhood. And so I was like, wouldn't it be great if we even had one more? And so that sort of persisted into my adulthood that I thought 4 was the magic number. And when I met my husband, you know, I was like, look, if you're not interested in having kids, you know, we're just not going to go any further because I really want to have kids. So, and he's like, I could have kids. And I was like, okay. And he's like, I could have kids and I could have like 2 kids. I was like, I want 4. And he was like, well, you know. And so we started with like the concept of 2.
Yeah.
Then 3 was a pretty easy sell. 3 was hard because we had like a lot of problems in the hospital. Like I had to live in the hospital for 9 weeks out of that
latter half
of the pregnancy. I had like complications. So at the end of that, both Chris and my dad were like, that's it. No more. We're not having, no, we can't risk you. We can't risk losing you, Mira, because I was slightly at risk and the baby was definitely at risk. And that's it. No more. We can't go through this again. And then so like the next year, like after a year, like my husband was like, okay, we could get rid of like the baby car seat now because we're going to switch to the toddler one and we could get rid of that stroller. And I was like, but what if we have a 4th baby? He's like, we're not having a 4th baby. And then I would just give him a little face, just a little, mm-hmm. little sad eye face, a little mopey face. And I did that for about a year. And all of a sudden, one day out of nowhere, he was like, okay, we can have a 4th baby, but then I can have any tattoo I want.
He traded a baby for a tattoo.
Well, the right to have any, like forever, like I could no longer say no to anything, even like, you know, well, I still am like categorically opposed to like the sleeving because he's an actor. And if he walks into a place and he's got like the tattoos all the way down to his hands, he can only really be cast as like an ex-con, a rock star, or like a carnival barker,
right.
You know, so he has to still be able to, you know, play universal kind of roles.
Did he get the tattoo yet?
He's gotten several tattoos since.
Oh, he has. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he's got like 7 or 8 tattoos. Yeah. But they're all tasteful. They're all nice, actually. I think they're nice.
So it all worked out okay.
It all worked out
great.
It
was a good trade.
I was like, whatever. You can have whatever. Like, you know, no face tattoos, please. You know, but like.
Right.
But yeah. So. But Chris is, well, when is this airing? This is airing Friday.
When does this go up, Katie?
Friday. Oh, okay. Well, the funny thing is, like, Saturday night, both Chris and I are on TV the same night.
This is Saturday the, what is the date? What's the date? I can't remember
is
what
it the
date
13th? Is. It'll be the 13th, right? Saturday the 13th.
Saturday the 13th.
So Intruders and Deliverance Creek are both going to be on the same night. And that's crazy because we've never been on the same night of anything. We both haven't done that much TV. And so, like, he's starring in this pilot. It's like a backdoor pilot for Lifetime called Deliverance Creek, which is like a Western set at the last 6 months of the Civil War. And he basically plays a character based on Jesse James, like a bushwhacker who becomes a bank robber and kind of drags his sister, played by Lauren Ambrose, into it. And then I've got Intruders, which, and so luckily, originally we thought they were airing exactly the same moment. We were like, what are the chances? But I think his is at 8 and mine is at 10. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
So then people can take a break.
They can have like a Bacca Sorvino family festival.
And then go.
Because I'm sure that's just what they want to do on yeah. Saturday. But they're both really great shows. So
so what did I, just for people who haven't seen it, what's the nickel pitch for Intruders?
Intruders is a chilling paranormal drama about a secret society that is chasing immortality by seeking refuge in the bodies of others. Da, da, da.
What?
Yes, and it's very creepy, very scary, very interesting, but ultimately it's sort of about love and death. And it's like, what would you do for those that you love? Would you kill for them? Would you die for them? Would life be worth living without them if you could live forever but without them? It's, you know, it's about this obsession we all have about like approaching death and, you know, mourning lost ones and wishing there was some way that you could see them again. And then there is in this. So it's very creepy, but it touches on stuff that all of us are a little bit deep down, very obsessed with, I think. So and it's beautifully shot, beautifully done, very creepy. Glenn Morgan, who hails from the X-Files, is our show creator. It's BBC America.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, it's got that edge to it, you know, that sort of paranormal Saturday thing that they have kind of down to a science. And Eduardo Sanchez directed the first four episodes, who did the Blair Witch Project. Mm-hmm. And Daniel Stamm, who did 13 Sins, I think, and I think it was The Last Exorcism, directed the second half. And we have great cast, James Frain, John Sim. We have this terrific little kid named Millie Brown who plays a mean old man like nobody's business. And you'll see, I mean, if you watch the show, you know what I'm talking about, but she's basically being if you watched the show up to this point, you have understood by this point that she is being inhabited. She's being taken over by the soul of a centuries old serial killer, a terrifying old man named Marcus Fox.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. And so she swings from being a little girl who's been like kind of abducted by this presence and is terrified when she comes to and just wants to get back to her mommy, to being this man capable of unbelievable evil, in the body of a small girl. And I am a woman who is really acting very strangely with her husband and very, very sad. And then at times distant. And then all of a sudden speaking languages that I have never spoken or listening to music that I have never listened to and acting with a different personality than he's used to. And obviously something's up with me too. And there's this eye thing that happens where the pupils dilate.
Right.
And then like another soul is kind of taking over.
So that's what that is.
Yeah. It's like,
now, did it ever occur to you as a prank on your husband? How long have you guys been together?
We just celebrated our 10-year wedding anniversary, but 11 years total.
Okay, so let's say year 6. You haven't told him any of the China stuff yet. And one night... let's go with me on this. That's too late now, but this is a hypothetical. Wouldn't have been funny if 6 years in the middle of the night... you start acting really weird and you start speaking fluent Chinese, but he has no idea that you've ever been to China. You could have freaked the shit out of him.
I could have, except that one of the first trips we took together when we were engaged was we went with Mr. Armani to China.
Oh.
So he experienced me speaking Chinese there and he was like, where's my wife? Who is this talking? Because all of a sudden I would, you know, Yeah, I'd be having this conversation with people in Chinese, and he was like, "This is so weird. Where's my wife?" So
he'd already knew.
Yeah, he'd already seen it. Damn. Yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? A missed opportunity, but
yes, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
It would have been good. Yes, but I would have had to do it really early, though.
So, do you have time to? Have you been back to China anytime recently?
No, I haven't been back since 2004. Yeah. Yeah, so and I hear it's changed so much since then. And at that point, it had changed so much from when I was in college and was there. I mean, night and day, huge difference. Like, you know, the economic changes to the system having become capitalist, and all of a sudden you have all this globalization there. Like, you had like Louis Vuitton and Starbucks and crazy, you know, American or European stuff there. Whereas before, there was no outside influence. There was nothing from the West. Maybe there was one hotel in Beijing that
and
was
you.
Sort of Western. Well, yeah, there were the foreign students that would all kind of hang out as like the expat community. But and me with my fake books, my jazz books that nobody had, and it was like contraband that I was like sharing with the musicians. And
oh wow!
Like, I think that's why they had me in their band so that they could like use my music. But
how did you when you first
my
came,
dad would send me the music from
when
from
you
US.
First came back from China? How did you feel different? I mean, obviously you were.
I wanted to go back. Like I loved my life over in China. Like I had kind of made peace with the expat experience, and I think because of the divorce, like I decided one day, okay. I'm on the bottom of the world and I can either sort of like, you know, like I'm literally like, you know, I'd have to dig a tunnel back to my home straight through the core of the earth to get back to New Jersey. So either I can just kind of crumple and feel sorry for myself or I can build like a new happy life here. And, you know, B seemed to be the better option. And so the second half of my time in China, I kind of righted myself and developed all these contacts and friends and found music that I liked and would bike all over on my bike throughout China and would travel to different provinces and had this singing stuff going on. And it was just a really, I took calligraphy classes and it was just a wonderful, amazing time. So when I went back to Harvard with one semester left, I had two semesters left. I had the end of my senior year. I had spring senior semester and all my friends graduated. And then I had one more semester to do to finish off because I had taken off senior fall. So I was like, well, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back and teach Chinese maybe. Like I worked for this group called World Teach. And I was like, maybe I'll go work in Guangdong province and I'll learn Cantonese and I'll teach English there and it'll be so exciting. And then maybe I'll do documentaries on shamanism in the countryside. Like I had this whole, you know, and then Tiananmen Square happened. That spring.
Oh, wow.
And it just changed everything for anybody who was sort of in the China field at that point, because we all felt that we would be like hurting our Chinese friends if we went back, like they would be in trouble for being contacted by Westerners. And we didn't want to just go back and be like expats living with expats and, you know, not living a Chinese style lifestyle. And we didn't want to show approval for what had happened. And so everybody was kind of like boycotting going back. And so that's probably why I'm an actor, like, because I might have gone on this completely different path after graduation. I would have maybe gone back to China and lived in China and become like a, you know, a person who lived overseas for many years. And maybe I might have gravitated back to performing. I mean, I know I had this friend there who her name was Nin Ying. She was the third AD on The Last Emperor, and she wanted me to play like an American Yoko Ono to like a Chinese boy band.
Uh-huh.
Like he was like a Chinese Beatles and I'd be like the white girlfriend that kind of breaks them up. so that was a possibility for me, but maybe I would have ended up acting. Maybe not. I don't know.
Did you date much when you were in China?
I dated a little bit.
I'm just curious to know how the, well, I mean, I guess it was a while ago, so maybe it's different now. But I mean, like the dating, because you said everything's changed in China now. But
right.
I wonder, coming in as a Westerner, like how do you sort of fold in? And
well, there was an expression that I had been warned about from my Chinese friends that was called like sometimes like Chinese people would call, you know, Westerners who would come in and date Chinese people, they would call them passports or plane tickets. So you always had to be suspect of a relationship unless it really seemed to be founded on true love, because, and you know, I think one guy who wanted to date me was very interested in like just getting out of China and like, you know, had completely ulterior motives for like, you know, being interested in me. And then I was kind of like had this huge crush on this like drummer, one of the drummers in the band, but he had like a long-term girlfriend, but it was just like I had this like big crush on him. But that was nothing to do with like the Fei Ji Piao, you know, the passport. But mostly I dated like foreigners. But I think, yeah, like you had to be suspect about, like, that was, you know, when you're living in like a, sort of a communist state, even though it was like less oppressive than it had been in, you know, the early 80s or the 70s, there were still so many strictures on people's lives that it was like a big dream for people to get out. You know, they just wanted to get out.
That's interesting. And you wanted to stay.
Yeah. Let me in.
No, get out.
Please. I want to stay. Well, we just went past an hour. I mean, it doesn't matter. We can go as long as we want, but I don't want to force you to stay here longer. But that, I mean,
we should probably talk more about intruders a little bit.
Well, we did. We covered it. And yeah, then we'll also put it at the beginning and BBC. I worked for BBC America a couple of years ago, and they're a great network to work for, and they really have started to understand.
Is
that a dribble can?
It's just me with my geriatric lower lip.
I feel like a BBC America really kind of understands like who their audience is and the types of programming, and they're doing such a great job. They're doing such a phenomenal job over there with Orphan Black and just like original, just sort of original, interesting ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing at the beginning of Intruders, I think some people felt like it was too confusing. Like that was like a note that some people gave, like in critiques or whatever. Like, wow, what's going on? I don't know. Like maybe, you know, this is too hard.
There's a focus group, so they don't matter.
And BBC was like, look, we respect the intelligence of our audience, and we are presenting them a mystery, and we're not going to give everything away in the first, and we stand behind it. What I want to say to audiences who are, you know, who've seen it and who are unsure, like, is it too confusing? Everything is about to be coming really, really clear very soon. So mm-hmm. like episode 4 that is coming on this weekend, all of a sudden you're going to start understanding a lot more about that. You'll see a lot more glimpses into the secret society, and you will see my connection to it. And it's kind of like the second half of the season is so mind blowing. Like it's so different from the first half. So what I can say to fans out there who are watching it but are a little bit like unsure, because sometimes on Twitter somebody like, well, I'm still trying to figure out episode 1 and 2. Like, hang in there, because it'll blow your mind everything's going to be revealed, and then the drama is crazy. Like, what happens is it's all kind of crazy what's coming up, and my character is crazy. Like, it's not like sweet little Amy that we're watching and like feeling sorry for her because she's in the throes of this sort of internal turmoil. Like, she changes a lot. Like, things happen and she's like... Yeah, it's like I'm a different person. Like, so it's really cool. It's really interesting. So I just want people to hang in there with it.
Good. So you're having fun.
Oh yeah. Good. Oh yeah. Oh no, it was an awesome role. It was awesome. It's a killer role. As the season goes on, it's two different people. So I'm playing two different people in one body, basically.
All right.
But the second person is really crazy. Like, it's like a totally, totally mind blowing kind of situation. So it's really interesting.
I don't know why. I just want to hear you speak Chinese. What could you say in Chinese? You could talk about... What if you were to talk about the show to a Chinese audience? Are you brushed up enough?
Oh no, I don't think so.
Well, no, there's just there's a lot of Chinese people who listen to the podcast who are like, and they go, well, I don't understand anything. If only someone, I mean, I'm going to keep listening to this podcast because eventually someone's going to say something that that means something to me.
Okay, let's see. 我特别喜欢你们都看我的新的 I can't say show. I don't remember the word for show.
Picture
intruders,
brain.
Intruders. It's not picture. That's picture brain. No, what is that? What is TV? How do you say TV? Now I forget. But anyway, I said I really hope you all watch Intruders.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Even do kan Intruders.
Oh, that's great. Do you just sort of co-opt English words for words that there aren't Chinese words for? Or is it sort of like the?
Oh, I mean, I couldn't really do that when I was over there, but now I do if I forget one. Sure. Like I just did.
Yeah, but that's a proper name, so that's totally acceptable.
Yeah, like Dianhua is a phone. What is it? Dian. What is it? It's electric something. Dianhua is electric, like voice, which is phone, and Dian Nao is electric brain, which is computer. So what the frick is
electric face?
No.
Electric face. Let's say it's electric face.
No, it's not.
Because I think that's a cool name for something.
How do you say TV? I don't remember. Sorry.
Can you say, do you know how to say enjoy your burrito in Chinese? There's probably not a Chinese. You probably just have to say burrito.
Yeah, no, yeah, I don't know how to say burrito. I'm sorry.
What about in French?
J'espère que tu t'amuses avec ton burrito.
Oh, so great. I'm sorry to try to.
That's right. I don't
want to make you a language puppet, but it's fucking awesome to. It's really great to hear. Chinese is just not one of those languages that people just waltz in and go, oh, by the way, I lived in China and I speak Chinese. It's such a great. I hope you enjoyed your time here on the podcast.
I did very much.
Come back. Oh, you know who I want to. Before we finish. I want to talk about your friend with
champagne.
Cancer.
Yes, Champagne. I was just on the phone Champagne with her before Joy. I got here. And Champagne Joy, who has her TV project, hashtag Cancerland, that she's working on, you know, kind of getting off the ground. But that's how we really met, because she was a huge fan of yours. And she was like, that's Chris Hardwick. Oh, my God. You have to talk with him. You've got to meet him.
She's so amazing. She's so fantastic. And I had no idea, and we hung out for most of the night, and we were just hanging out afterwards, and she was like, oh, yes, and I also have stage 4 cancer. I'm like, yeah. You have what? Because she's so...
vital, yeah.
So vital, and there's nothing about her that seems like there's any malady whatsoever, and it's but she's so positive, and it all... She's one of those people that really makes you go, oh yeah, I don't really have problems, and I obsess over stupid shit.
Right.
Because
right.
Here's this woman who not only is living a very outgoing, energetic life, and she has very serious cancer, but she also is devoted her life to support groups and to, like, you know, if you don't have someone to talk to, if you need someone, if you know. Then she's dedicating, you know, she's
dedicating
herself.
Yeah, she's trying
herself.
To create a resource through hashtag Cancerland to be like a resource from anyone who is battling this disease, you know, and she wants that to be her legacy. I keep telling her, you know, not to give up the ghost just yet, that even, you know, people do come back from stage 4. They do. I you know, it happens. So I just, you know, they give you a terminal diagnosis and I just don't want that to go, you know, to be a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, just because I think the brain is a really important aspect of fighting mm-hmm. a disease. But, you know, we're close anyway. There's so many treatments that are happening that, you know, years ago we didn't have any of them. And I've just been on the phone with her today on my way over here and we caught up, and she's an amazing person. She's really inspirational, and she's so funny. I mean, she's really funny.
Hilarious.
As soon as she got cancer, she dyed her hair blue.
Yeah.
And she's normally a redhead. And we've known each other since we were 14. And I met her right before I met Ramon, who was my fashion influence with the punk clothes. And she was friends with Ramon as well. And she was an actress at the time, and she was in a Woody Allen movie, and she's managed bands. She's been worked in a law office for a long time. She's just an amazing human being, just the best counselor. Like, if you need human advice that you really can trust, she is the best. Like, sort of sees straight to the core of a matter, understands human nature so well, but always has like a sense of humor. Her mother is a rather famous psychic, actually. Her mother's name is Grace Spear, and she wrote a book called Everything Talks to Me. And her husband, Michael Hall, is an amazing guy, and has a pretty terrific body of photography that he does. But anyway, they're great, great people. And I don't know. I threw her a benefit party along with a ton of wonderful friends this summer at Number 8 in New York, and you know, raised some money for medical expenses and a lot of awareness. And she's like, she herself is the embodiment of like life. Like, she is just like a person who is so, you cannot imagine her not being alive. So this is, I mean, I just want to do everything I can for her. I'm like looking up all these like alternative cures, but she's right now on a really, really serious chemo regime. And you can't add anything to the mix right now. Like, and I'm like, but couldn't you try this? And she's like, you have to trust me that the doctors, you know, have their protocol, and you know, as soon as we see how this is working, then we can see what we can add to it. But right now, you know, we've got to see how this new regimen is taking. I mean, I did that Stand Up to Cancer telecast thing the other day where we called people who had been supporters of Stand Up to Cancer in the past. And I spoke to all of these survivors or people who had lost people to it. And it was just very, very moving and mind-blowing. And I spoke to this woman who was an 8-year cancer survivor, and she was saying, how in a certain way it had realigned her priorities, and been a good thing. She had like seen some good in it somehow, and that it, she felt like just at the right time, there were like little angels around her, like people showed up just out of nowhere who like became angels to her, and that she stripped down like what she thought was important in life. And now like feels like she is grateful for every day, and she feels blessed to be around. And so she said that she felt that positivity also was the thing that helped her beat it, you know, to the extent that she's beaten it now, and that a positive attitude was like the key. But I mean, she was incredible. She was an inspiration to talk to. So I just try and be there for Champagne and help her. But, you know, ultimately it's her fight that she's fighting. You know, there's nothing we can, you know, you want to wave a magic wand for the people you love and be like, I want to take this all away from you. And you can't, you know, so it's just, it's, that's really hard, you know, because I've had hard times in the past few weeks where I'm just, you know, I'm sort of like, I did love original Star Trek, as you probably know, with my obsession with Captain Kirk and Shatner and all that. And yes. I have all the paraphernalia at home. I have the phasers and the communicators and the little deck and little revolving fake.
The transporter yeah. that you could spin that. Yeah.
But I was very influenced, or perhaps just naturally born, to the concept of, you know, not accepting the no-win scenario. So how he like faked the
Kobayashi Maru.
Yeah. And I never want to say that it's impossible, that there's, you know, a no exit, you know, that we're in a like terminal situation. Like I was like, there's something else we can do. We can always figure out a way, like where there's a will, there's a way. We're going to build a barn. We're going to find a cure. We're going to do something. We're going to, you know, and, you know, that's hubris because none of us have that ability. But I'm struggling with that because I don't really want to accept a no-win scenario for her. I don't want to accept that.
Well, so. But it's, I think it's still good despite that to have that attitude.
Yeah, no, it serves you. It serves you to have that attitude because it allows you to do a lot of things that other people would say that's impossible to do.
And it also forces you to sort of think creatively and try to figure out, you know, to try to see things that maybe if you would just resign yourself and be like, there's nothing I can do, you know, well, but maybe, you know, that idea of, but maybe there is, I mean, that's worked.
Yeah. So, no, I've been like finding all these like possibilities through people I know for her, and she's going to explore all of them. So,
I just think people should, and you should, is it Champagne Joy on Twitter, or is it Champagne_Joy?
There it is. Champagne_Joy
at Champagne_Joy.
Yeah. And she has the blue hair and the orange kimono on. Like, you'll know you're in the right place.
But, you know, seek her out, say hi to her, find her, give her Twitter love. If you're going through something, she wants to help. And but she's so, so cool.
Yeah. She's so cool. She'll be really excited that you thought of her, because she definitely was like, oh, I'm so happy that you're doing that. That's awesome. You know,
well, I'm happy that you were doing it too. It's been so nice talking to you, and it's such a good time a couple weeks ago, and it's been a pleasure, and thank you for coming out here.
Thank you. Next time we'll have to talk about my about human trafficking, because that's my whole other like side of my life that has taken over me kind of in a very large way, but it's not a conversation for tonight. But
no, but you can come back time. And you
yeah,
can talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, maybe when I have something going on, like, but I work, you know, I'm a UN Goodwill Ambassador on human trafficking, and I have been since 2009. So that's like my big other side of my life, where I got to take all the Harvard stuff and all the speech writing and all the social justice stuff from like the racial conflict and all that, and put it into the modern day slavery stuff. So that's still part of me. Mm-hmm. So I still have that part of myself that hasn't gone to sleep. Which I'm glad.
Is there a website or something that you want to plug for people to get information about that?
Well, sure. I mean, they could follow UNODC on Twitter. They could go to the Polaris.org website if they want to get involved in anti-trafficking initiatives in the United States. It's a great one-stop shopping place because you can find out whatever's happening in your state on trafficking. So you could either support legislation that needs to be passed, or you could join a local group that is working to fight trafficking or to help victims. So it's a great way to get involved. If you're in Los Angeles, CAST LA is a great group to follow and to get involved with. They really are the number one service provider to trafficking victims in the area, but also ECPAT USA, ECPAT International, and Child Prostitution and Trafficking. That's what it stands for. But if you're specifically ired by child sex trafficking, they're the people to get involved with. But, you know, there's a lot that people can do. They just have to kind of wake up and realize that slavery is still alive and well. So we all need to fight it. But Anyway.
Well, you come back and we can talk more about that too.
Okay.
Okay.
I see my children are calling me.
Oh, please go ahead.
No caller ID is always them.
Oh, okay.
That's,
where are you?
Mommy, Johnny hit me.
What? Mommy's doing a podcast. Yeah. Podcasts are dumb. All right, cool. I will let you go back to your large Italian family.
Thank you.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Every year, 50 teenage girls, one from every state, show up in Mobile, Alabama to compete in the largest cash scholarship competition exclusively for high school girls. They spend months training to win the big prize. But what happens when a Supreme Court decision leaves many of them feeling unprepared for the real world?
A lot of the girls were crying, and I never seen any of them cry before.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. I'm your host, Shima Oliai. Follow me behind the scenes as all 50 girls are catapulted into the center of a nationwide debate about their rights. What do they think of their changing country? Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.